This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to TY Takeover 2025. You're all very welcome. Coming up over the next hour, we'll hear how the accommodation crisis is impacting students' lives, what role fast food plays in obesity, and how streaming has shaken up the music industry. But first, as you know, rent is constantly increasing. According to the latest RTB report, the average rent has increased again by 6.4%, with student accommodation increasing by 3%, a trend that shows no sign of ending. Our team, Ava, Charlie, Rosemary, and myself, Rory, went out to the streets of Dublin to ask the public what they think.
1,600 euro a month?
A lot more.
That's a 2,000.
A little bit more?
2,500.
Yeah. How do you feel about that?
It feels really bad. That's a lot of money.
That's crazy.
Are you guys renting yourselves?
Yeah, but right now we're in student accommodation.
Oh, okay.
And I'll stay in student accommodation for next year as well.
Yeah, and that works for you. You find that a good setup.
Yeah. I like the idea of not being alone. Like, I feel like I get really lonely if I live in an own, like, apartment by myself. So I like the idea of not being alone all the time.
Yeah, community.
Exactly,
and people your own age kind of.
Yeah.
If you were Taoiseach for a day, what is the change that you would make that you think would help with that problem?
Well, I think the rent pressure zones are a good idea, and the building of more housing in Dublin, I think that'd be good. But then also to make sure that you don't, like, put pressure on landlords to not just increase the prices all the time.
Are you renting or are you living here?
We're renting.
And do you know what the average rent in Dublin costs?
Monthly?
Yeah.
Probably like 1,300, I would have thought.
What do you think the government could do to improve that for like students living here?
Build more houses. Build more apartments. More places to live. I don't know.
I've only got three nice parties.
Probably that. More places to live.
Have you considered living in Ireland? When you're
why not? I like it.
Where is your home country?
I'm living in Germany, but I'm here as an au pair.
Could you give a guess at what the average rent in Dublin is?
Oh my god, I've never paid rent. I still live with my parents. Really bad, probably. I know it's really high, so I don't know, over thousands a month?
It's
I don't know.
A lot more.
I don't know.
Would you believe me if I said it's nearly 2,500 euros a month?
Yeah, I would believe you, but I wouldn't say it's okay.
Yeah. What do you think about that? Do you think it should be a lot lower?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I live in Killiney, south county Dublin, yeah.
So do you rent or own?
I own my own house.
Oh, do you?
Yes.
What do you think that the cost of renting in Dublin would be, if you take a guess?
Oh, I'd say it's around three grand a month.
Or 2 grand a month? Yeah, that's about it.
Yeah.
Do you think it's stressful for students paying for accommodation?
Absolutely, yeah, of course they do.
My
sympathy for them. I've used sympathy for anybody paying extravagant rents, yeah.
To discuss these extravagant rents, as well as other issues putting pressure on students, we are joined here today by the President of the Union of Students in Ireland, Chris Clifford. Hello, Chris. Thank you very much for your time. Could I just start by asking you, if you were the Taoiseach, what would be the first thing you would address when it comes to the students' struggle to find accommodation?
The first thing I would do anyway is release the student accommodation strategy paper. This is something they've been promising for years now. And I think that is one of the priorities that needs to be looked at pretty much straight away. In regards to the TU sector, I'd implement the TU borrowing policy and the plan they have in place. They're going to be given out. It's kind of like a template of how the building should be and all that kind of stuff. So they'd be kind of the biggest things that need to be addressed. And that's what I'd address instantly anyway.
Mm. And what advice would you give to young people and students looking to rent places in Dublin?
Renting places in Dublin, it's not easy. At the minute, I think it's to, if I was a Leaving Cert student now, I'd probably look as early as you possibly can. Don't turn down the options of digs, but ensure that it's safe and to be aware for scams as well is definitely a priority.
Would you recommend any specific websites for students?
Currently, none of them are they're monitored, but they're are moderated, but they're not safe at times. We've seen a lot of instances where international students are going for accommodation, and there's situations that occur there. And then we have also situations that occur where it's advertised as you're sharing with other tenants, but it turns out to be the homeowner. So at the minute, like Daft and all them, they're not fully safe. So it's tough to give a recommendation at the minute.
Mm. And how would you describe your experience of finding accommodation in Dublin?
My experience as the president of USI was a very difficult one. I was very lucky at the start. I one of my actual a guy I was in college with, I moved in with him, and I stayed with him. But I for the first couple of months. But when I was looking for new accommodation for myself, it was very very challenging. So much so I had to move out to further out of the Dublin area and then just commute.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'll pass you on to Rosemary now.
Do you think that the cost of living is a push factor for many students to leave Ireland to live or study abroad?
Absolutely. I think there's, the employment, there's great employment rate there. But just at the minute, like trying to balance accommodation costs, your regular day-to-day costs with everything is just, it's very, very hard. I was out of my group of students from my class, like I think there's two of us remaining in Ireland, and I'm 29 years of age. So it's really making people move out of the country because as you get to my age, people are trying to buy houses and look at that kind of side of life, and mortgages are just impossible to get.
And have you ever considered emigrating yourself?
I have. So when I was a former MTU Kerry Students' Union president up until 2 years ago, and I ran for this position, but my alternative was that I would have immigrated if I didn't get it. So it was definitely something I looked at for sure.
Many students feel pressured to work jobs whilst learning in college and focus less on their studies. What more could be done to support students financially?
So reducing the cost of public transport significantly is something that we're very much advocating for. That's one of the biggest things because it's a huge cost. On top of that, the fees, the rates of fees at the minute, there's always uncertainty about that because every year they say that they reduce it as a one-time payment to €2,000. So at the start of September, people don't know if they're paying €3,000 or if they're paying €2,000. So that's something that's very, very, very challenging. So if they looked at those kind of things, I think it would help. But students are working more than they ever did, let's say, when I would have been in college. So it's a difficult one.
Our next question is, we were really interested to read that in 2023, you and many other students protested in Dublin seeking to see €2.7 billion allocated by the government to build student accommodation. And we wondered, did anything come of this? And what was the reaction you got? How did the government respond to that?
So in 2023, that was last year. So then, yeah, so we would have seen a few increases. So the fees that they remained at the €2,000. That was something that we did push for. We wanted it to reduce more, but it stayed at €2,000. The PhD stipend increased was another one of our wins. Mental health support stayed at €5 million. They would have been kind of our three most significant ones. And they have started looking now at SUSE grant reform. So the grant that is there for college students. So all these kind of things, but it's we're really just a cog in the system of it keeping going, because from those 2023 wins, some of those wins would have been seen later on in, let's say, towards kind of 2024 and the budget for 2025.
Yeah, it's still a really big achievement, though. So congratulations. And for moving on, do you feel that the government actively engages with students in Ireland?
We're the national body that voices students' opinions, so I think they could do a lot more. I think when Minister Harris, Simon Harris, Taoiseach Simon Harris, when he was there, I think he was very, very good at engaging with the student movement. At the minute, we've reached out to Minister James Lawless and we're yet to have a meeting with him, but he's new. We're going to be patient and hope for the best that he will prioritise students' interests and meet with ourselves and other organisations fairly frequently.
Let's hope so. And we're all 16 years old, and we and many other young people our age are really quite worried about our future and the cost of living. In fact, 67% of young people listed this as their biggest concern, according to the National Youth Council of Ireland. So for these people, what is your advice for young people who might be anxious about their future?
I think it's just to take it as it comes. Like, look, I think the government, this, I think, like, from USI's perspective, we were hoping for the current opposition that they would get into government. And I think a lot of people your age were thinking that as well. But unfortunately, people just didn't get out and vote. I think young people should educate themselves when it comes to it, because they'll be, if it stays for 5 years, if this current government stays for the full 5 years, you'll be looking at probably being in your second or third year of studies. And to be educated and to vote for the right person at that time. And that's one of the biggest things. But I also think, you know, prioritizing getting at 16, it's very difficult. I didn't know what I wanted to do at 16. I didn't think I'd be the president of the USI at 16. But I really think that, like, kind of having an idea of where you want to study and what you want to do, and especially in transition year, that's when I would have found, when I knew kind of my calling was the degree I studied in. So I think that would kind of be the main focus. And then if you have older brothers and sisters and encourage them to actually get involved in student politics and voice it, because it'll affect ye.
Yeah. Chris Clifford, president of the USI, thanks so much for your time. Coming up on the show, Ben will be talking to Richie McCormack and Marty Guilfoyle about the challenges and benefits that streaming platforms bring to Irish artists. But first, the not-so-glamorous side of fast food in Ireland.
We're taking over! TY Takeover!
This is News Talk.
Welcome back to the TY Takeover. I'm Anna, your host for this segment. Our segment was produced by our group, Rossa, Andrew and Kate, and I'm joined now with Andrew and Kate.
Hi.
If you're just tuning in, our previous group were just discussing immigration and cost of living. This afternoon, we will be discussing the obesity problem in Ireland and how this is impacted by American fast food chains, with help from our special guest, Professor Donal O'Shea.
But first, earlier this week, we were let loose on Grafton Street to see what the public think of American fast food in Ireland. While we were in town, we also asked some small business owners the struggles they face while running a smaller business in Ireland.
The challenge would be competition. There's a lot of coffee shops around in the Dalby city centre, so I'd say the competition is one of the biggest things. The prices of everything as well. At the moment, we are facing serious problem with the prices of coffee, so we're trying to be as competitive as we can with the prices and everything.
More likely to buy from a chain restaurant or a small local business, and why?
Working here, I mean, it's a chain, but it's, you know, it's local. We make our own products. So I know the advantages. I mean, there's higher quality of food, but there's always the price point. You want to treat yourself, of course, always the local food chain. The food is always at least 50% better. But every once in a while, everyone wants McDonald's. Everyone wants a dirty Big Mac.
What American fast food would you like to see come to Ireland?
One. Raisin Cane.
Would you be more likely to try a food because it's trending online?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I'm easily 100%. Influenced.
What influences you to eat fast food? So is it the advertisements? Is it the
price?
Students,
yeah.
And like, it's just, yeah, handy to grab.
So how often do you think you have fast food?
Then quite rarely.
As we just heard, there's a lot of excitement around big food chains coming to Ireland. But this isn't as positive as it seems. Ireland has the second highest rate of obesity in Europe. Here to discuss this further is Professor Donal O'Shea.
For the people at home that don't know him, Donal O'Shea is the HSE's National Clinical Lead for Obesity, a professor and a regular commentator on the importance of preventing obesity. Donal is here today to talk to us about the dangers of fast food and American influence on our diets. Donal, can I start by asking, according to recent HSE research, almost 60% of adults in Ireland are obese. Are you concerned about this rate and the fact it may increase? Also, what can we do to prevent this?
So, obviously very concerned about the obesity rates in Ireland and globally. Obesity, we know, drives over 200 chronic diseases, as well as affecting people's mental health. And to have so many people carrying that burden of disease, it's a real worry for the future. And of course, the childhood overweight and obesity rates ultimately are what drive into the adult obesity problems we have. In terms of prevention, it's all about addressing the sedentary lifestyle and the nutrition environment, where we have ultra processed foods being delivered to people in their homes. In the olden days, there used to be a takeaway where you went to the restaurant or the fast food outlet and took it away, it now arrives at your house. So you're not even having to make the effort of traveling to the takeaway.
Do you think that the bringing of American fast food chains in Ireland has made an impact on these rates of obesity?
There is absolutely no doubt but that the arrival of the fast food outlets from America in the 70s was the tipping point in Ireland's obesity epidemic. So McDonald's and Burger King arrived onto O'Connell Street and Grafton Street in the 1970s, and there were queues outside because they had promotions and they had toys with products for kids. And at that point, Ireland's obesity rates were low by comparison. And in the 40s and 50s, we had been the thinnest country in Europe. So we had just about caught up in the 70s. And then arrive the fast food outlets from the United States and we just took off.
Do you think that there should be a tax or other labels on processed foods and like takeaway foods like there is on the sugar tax?
I'm working very hard to make sure that we reach exactly that point where we effectively tax the ultra processed foods and takeaway foods in an aggressive way that impacts on people's eating habits, and that the money generated from that, those taxes, is then put into incentivizing healthy food, encouraging breastfeeding, the things that we know make a difference over a person's life course to their overall health and their risk of having obesity.
So when a person is obese, sometimes there's a bit of a stereotype that they're lazy or they're not putting enough work in to fix this problem. Do you think that's fair, or do you think it's maybe because of the lack of education and awareness on nutrition?
Yeah, so we know that most people who are living with obesity have that attitude to themselves. They think it's their fault. And in fact, you know, the science has moved on. The understanding within the medical community has moved on. Obesity is a complex disease that's a combination of genes and environment, like many other chronic diseases. And there are two people who can eat the same amount and be similarly active, and one person can be 20 kilos heavier than the other based on their genes. And we admit people to our service here for 6 weeks of a kind of an aggressive inpatient program of nutrition and physical activity and a very low calorie intake. And some of our patients lose no weight at all. So how the body defends against weight loss, we understand much better. It's not a matter of willpower, but still patients self-stigmatize.
And then especially online, a lot of like there's a lot of fast food being promoted and stuff like that. Do you think that Irish influencers should encourage healthier eating because they have such a large platform?
I think that whole area of influencers is going to be really important in how we shape people's thinking. At the moment, there is no actual definition of an influencer is. So it's very hard to regulate something that isn't defined. There's no definition, believe it or not, of what an ultra-processed food is. So you can't regulate ultra-processed food, and that's a problem. So I certainly want to see Irish influencers have changed the model of promoting, allowing ads on their platform to promote fat, high salt, sugar food to a much healthier product been promoted. You know, Ireland is an agricultural nation. We're a nation where you can have good access to the outdoors. So we shouldn't be in the trouble we're in with the obesity rates we have.
According to Sports Ireland, by the age of 13 to 15, many girls have labelled themselves not sporty and are living by this label, with few attempts to counter it. What are your opinions on this, and how do you think this affects young women's health?
So that's one of the most disappointing statistics that I have come across over in recent years, that cliff edge that happens to girls in terms of sporting activity at that teenage, early teenagers. The effect that has when people drop out of sporting activity, it's way beyond physical. The life lessons you learn through being involved in sport, the lifelong physical health benefits of it are huge. The kind of routine and the discipline you get sport will have you more easily out of your social media environment and engaged in real activity that you're sharing with other people in person and not online. And that's the huge challenge that we have with the impact of social media presenting unrealistic, unattainable physical achievement. Whereas if you're out with your own peers, whether it's swimming up and down in the pool or playing Gaelic or whatever your sport is, or your activity is, when you're doing it with other people in those formative years, it's huge. And that's what we've seen from the impact of COVID in the people who are currently sitting there kind of leaving cert and early university. They missed out on a bit of that at a really important time, and many of them are struggling more than previous years.
All right, Donald, last question. How much fast food should someone consume in a year?
In a year? Well, in my year, motto for fast, yeah, my motto for with fast food or around that discussion is about everything in moderation. So in our house, we will have a takeaway once a month. But it's not going to be, you know, three times a week. And so you have to decide and look at your own. It would be a really good discussion for everybody to have within their own family. You know, what's right for us in terms of fast food. But fast food is ultra processed almost exclusively. And that's what we're trying to minimize in the diet. So you have to think less is better. But there isn't an absolute answer to your question.
Thank you so much for speaking to us.
Up next, after the break, we'll be discussing issues surrounding the music industry. Stay tuned.
We're taking over! TY Takeover!
This is News Talk.
Welcome back to TY Takeover. Before the break, you heard a bit about American fast food in Ireland. I'm your host, Ben Ashmore, and now we'll be talking about the music industry and the effect of streaming services on artists and platforms. Nowadays, as you know, streaming services completely dominate music revenue, with physical music accounting for about a quarter of global revenue, with this figure only getting lower each year. Some people say these services are exploiting artists for profit, but Spotify only recorded their first ever profit of €1 billion last year, compared to a loss of €500,000 in 2023. Many problems have arisen recently with the lack of income for creators on streaming services, with artists only earning 0.4 cent per stream. The other side of this argument is that music is so much more accessible to make and listen to now, with no need for record contracts, physical music, and algorithms pushing new music to people who never would have listened to it. We're joined now by radio presenter and DJ Marty Guilfoyle to hear his side of things. How have you seen the music industry change over the last 20 years?
So, like, over the last 20 years, when I was like 12, so 20 years ago, I would have been buying CDs and stuff. In fact, actually, I think minidisc was still a thing at the time as well. So obviously it's progressed into like online streaming and stuff. I've also noticed that you could release a song 10, 15 years ago and you could do really, really well after a weekend. But now with like TikTok and Instagram and Snapchat and stuff, you could have a song out 3 years and it might pop off. So obviously everybody is streaming their stuff online. No one's buying hard copies anymore. I know that vinyls have kind of come, you know, a nice novelty now. So they're making a bit of a comeback. But the whole physical side of owning a track is gone, which is really, really sad. And now everything's just gone online, I guess.
What's your opinion on the amount that artists are paid from streaming platforms? And do you think it's less than it would have been before streaming services were so popular?
Absolutely, 100%. I think this kind of goes down to kind of more of like singer-songwriters, because a lot of people don't realize that when an artist puts out a song, sorry, that was my car beeping there. When an artist puts out a song, there's a team, there's a whole team on the track. If you go into the credits of a song, you can see the whole team. And a lot of times, some of the big artists that you guys listen to, like some of the big dance DJs and stuff, might not have actually touched a track at all. So there are people who've put in the creative work and they're just not getting a fair cut of the track. There's also like a service called Splice that a lot of DJs use, which has like vocals on it that are royalty free. So you pay a subscription to this service and you can download a singer and use them without needing to credit them. And a lot of artists have unfortunately seen that their songs have gone super viral. They might have been owed thousands, but because they sold the track to Splice for maybe 50 quid to 100 euro, they're not entitled to anything. So it tends to be the people behind the scenes who I feel like are not fairly supported when it comes to the royalty split on these kind of platforms. The artists always get the tour out of it. They make their money from gigs and stuff, but it's the writers behind the scenes who I think suffer a big time.
You were talking about like social media. Do you think that the way songs sort of go viral nowadays, do you think that like affects how they write songs to be more catchy? Or
that is such a good question, Ben. Like, they really do. I've actually even found out, like myself, going back and forth with my producers trying to figure out what we should put together next. And I'm like, well, this is trending on TikTok, so maybe we should make this. One of my producers, he's really, really good. He's very talented. Will always kind of fight me back on that and say, no, stick to what you believe in. And there's this constant battle of, you know, do I put something out that I think is catchy, that I think people will like, or do I put something out that I believe in? And if I'm being completely honest, I still haven't figured that out yet. I'd love to put out like proper heavy dance music, but unfortunately, I feel like I can't do that right now. You know what I mean? So it absolutely influences what some people do. A lot of people are sticking to what they believe in, which is great. But the people who are making money are absolutely going down, I guess, what you could call like the TikTok edit route 100%.
What do you think could be done to improve how artists are paid on Spotify and platforms like that?
Good question. And I wish I had an answer to it. I think if the singer-songwriters had an answer to it, there'd be, you know, they'd be happier. I guess there'd be less kind of, you know, uproar about it all. The thing is these platforms, at the end of the day, you get a different royalty split. Like when you get a play on Spotify, a play on Apple Music is worth more. A play on Tidal is worth huge. That's the Jay-Z's platform. That's worth the most, you know? So, and the SoundCloud play is at the bottom. So I guess it's kind of up to these streaming services. But the hard thing is you're dealing with these big, massive companies that, you know, they want to make as much profit as they can. And you've only ever seen a couple of artists kind of like revolt against them. Like you saw Taylor Swift, a while ago, just pull her music completely. And yeah, she started recording all of her own versions and stuff so she could make her own money. But the average person putting out music, like, they still need to be seen. They still need to be heard. Like, they just don't have the power to kind of put it up to these, you know?
What advice would you give to new artists sort of trying to emerge in this era of streaming and how to be successful, maybe?
Yeah, I think it's advice that nobody wants to hear, especially as a DJ, but I feel like you need to spend less time in the studio and more time on social media. I've actually pulled back a lot of time I spend on social media because I find it can be a bit of a weird place sometimes. But at the end of the day, when it comes to labels and gigs and selling tickets and stuff, you need people to recognize you. And I've seen a lot of artists release huge hits, end up with millions of Spotify followers, but not get booked for gigs because people know the song, but they don't know the DJ. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's a hard piece of advice for someone who's really creative and into songwriting to hear. I'd say split it up nearly to 80% getting out there and putting out videos and become known, and then 20% in the studio. Whereas 15 years ago, it was the other way around. It was 80% in the studio and 20% out and about. But I guess that's just the game that we have to play now, you know?
Yeah. I know that you play concerts abroad. Would you say that's like a vital part of your career, having to like leave Ireland to play gigs?
Absolutely. Because us as Irish people, we love to travel. A lot of Irish people hate Ireland at the moment. So any excuse to get out of Ireland, they take it.
Yeah.
So like I've got like Edinburgh coming up, and that'll just be a gig full of Irish people who live in Edinburgh, you know? And the idea is that hopefully one day when they come back, we put on a big gig in Ireland, they'll be like, oh, we saw Marty in Scotland, so we'll go see him here. The summertime, I spend it mainly in Spain and Greece. A lot of young Irish people go over there on holidays and stuff. And again, the same thing. It's kind of like you hope when they come back to Ireland, they go, oh, we saw him in Greece. We saw him in Spain. We'll go see him live here. It's huge. And I find that, look, you know, we're all at our happiest when we're abroad in the sunshine and stuff. So if you can kind of help create those memories with people when they're abroad, like, it's, I guess you can hope that they'll come see you when you're at home as well.
Yeah.
Would you say you do it more for the enjoyment or the money?
If I was doing it for the money, I'd be in a different job. but obviously, look, over the last 14, 15 years, the money has gotten better. And like, I'm not going to lie and say a lot of gigs, the money is really, really good. But you have to do it for the enjoyment. You're told no 95% of the time. Yeah. If you were doing it for the money, you're in it for the wrong reasons, especially when it comes to streaming. But when it comes to gigs, the bigger the capacity, yeah, there's absolutely a lot of money to be made. But the problem is maintaining it. It's all well and good getting all that cash in 1 year, and then you're not relevant anymore and you fall flat. Like, what happens then, you know?
Very unpredictable.
So unpredictable. But I kind of like that. I kind of like the volatility. My other half, she works in a 9-to-5 job with Google. She loves that. She loves her routine. She knows that on one day of the month, she's getting paid every year, whereas I'm just going day by day, just trying to figure it all out still.
Thank you for your time.
No problem at all, Ben.
We took to the streets of Dublin and asked the public, as well as music professionals, what they thought of this current era of streaming services.
It's really hard for young artists and bands to get anywhere in the world if they're expected to live off such a small amount of money. For established artists that are in the business a long time, you know, they've already made their money, so for them, streaming's maybe not as important, but for young bands and artists, streaming is kind of the primary way they can try to make a living from it. So, like, making such a tiny percentage of a cent per play is just unfair.
I suppose, like, everyone gets their music from Spotify. No one really listens to them anywhere else, so I feel like they should get a lot of money from that.
I think they've made it more accessible for smaller artists to kind of create a fan base. I like to go to concerts, and if there's like a smaller artist coming to Ireland, I will go out of my way to go to them. I find that merch is ridiculously overpriced, so wouldn't really go so far as that. But concerts, yes. Everything else, no.
So where do you get your music?
I mostly listen on Spotify.
And how much do you think the artists are getting per stream?
I know, because I'm an artist myself. They don't get anything, almost like 2 cents per stream, not even 2 cents. Yeah, it's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable, yeah. Do you own any music, like CDs or vinyls?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I don't really listen to them. It's just like for a collection.
Would you go out of your way to try support artists by buying physical music, concert tickets, or merch?
I try to do my best, but sometimes it's too expensive, and sometimes it's also like to buy a CD, you don't really listen to it, you know.
We're joined now by Off the Ball's Richie McCormack to hear his opinion on things. Richie, how do you feel listening to artists on streaming services, being aware of the lack of payment? Like, are you aware of the lack of payment?
Yeah, I'm acutely aware, actually, to the point that I changed streaming services for what it's worth in the last couple of months. I'd been on Spotify for, I guess, in around a decade by this stage. And given the way that they've treated artists, given their streaming rate, which I think is 3/1000th of a euro per stream, it did, like, basically influenced my decision to ditch them and went to Apple Music. And in fairness, Apple Music are no saints themselves, but the streaming industry in general hasn't necessarily been beneficial for small to medium sized artists.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's easier for upcoming music artists to release music and gain popularity due to, like, streaming platforms and social media?
It is infinitely easier for younger artists to release music now, because beforehand you had the gatekeeper of labels who would go out and scout you and all that kind of stuff. Whether you're able to gain popularity or not, that's a different question entirely, because that requires a whole other set of skills and a whole other set of work and a massive slice of luck on the artist's behalf, because, like, that all depends on whether you connect with your audience. Like, you can absolutely put your product out there if you're a musician, but can you actually get it across to the audience that you want to get it across to, and maybe even beyond that as well, to an audience that you never knew you were looking for?
How do you think streaming platforms such as Spotify have affected how much actual radio music people listen to?
A massive amount, because the idea that you would sit and wait for your favourite song to come on the radio, I'd imagine is probably anathema to people that are your age. You'd know more than me. I'm probably more than double your age at this stage. But yeah, like, I don't want to sound like the old fart in the room, but the time was where you either requested the song you were looking for or and in the hopes that it would be among the next ones to come up. But the reality is DJs on major radio stations these days, without wanting to bring down the fourth wall, they don't have a say in what they're playing. So you're not going to be able to influence what they do play. So your only course of action is to go and play what you actually want to listen to, which in this day and age is to go to a streaming service.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of leading on from what Tom said, but like, what changes have you noticed in the way people listen to music since streaming services became so popular?
There's a complete breakdown in a positive way of genres and of eras. People don't necessarily listen to a song and tie it to a specific movement. Like back in the day, you would have said, that's a metal song, that's a goth song.
Yeah.
That whole thing has been broken down. And similarly, people don't see artists of the 70s or 80s. They listen to the song more than they'd listen to, or they take into account what generation it's from. So it's completely, absolutely completely flattened the earth in terms of how people approach music.
In your opinion, has streaming made it harder for smaller artists to be noticed?
Yes, because the major streaming services will put front and centre the ones that are going to bring them the biggest revenues and the most ears and the most eyeballs. So they will look after, first and foremost, your, you know, whoever's popular at the moment, Chappell Roan or Lady Gaga or whoever it happens to be. They'll be the ones that they go after, Taylor Swift, to try and promote themselves off the back of the artist's work, whereby you are just going to be left for dead and to fend for yourself if you're one of the smaller artists or if you're a young artist starting out. And even if you're somebody who is used to a certain income from your music by means of physical sales down through the years, if you've been around since the 80s and 90s, you've watched that whole economy die away, and you're now scrambling for new ways to kind of try and find ways to make a living, essentially.
I think streaming services also now like massively control who they like promote, because before, like music shops could have said, oh, we recommend this like artist.
Yeah. And even then, that would have been, like, I worked in HMV when it was still a music shop back in the early 2000s, and that was dictated from on high, from like central office, essentially, what you were going to promote. So even still, there wasn't even the autonomy that there is belonging to shops, major chains anyway, to promote who they wanted to.
What do you think has changed now that radio isn't the primary way that artists are being recognised?
They don't have to fit into, as I mentioned, they're a certain type of, like, they can be themselves and manage to get themselves popular. Like, I don't think there would have been, like, back in the 90s, 2000s, people would have been trying to pigeonhole a Chappell Roan or even Taylor Swift as a certain type of thing. Whereas now, if you're an artist, you've got a lot more leeway to decide what your music is actually going to be. In terms of, you know, building popularity, in terms of getting noticed, music is very front-loaded these days. Like, everything has to be impactful from the off. So TikTok has actually had a massive impact on that, whereby the first few seconds of a song has to be, you have to be able to grab onto it and has to keep your attention. And if not, you're gone, you're dead. And similarly, it's killed, in my view anyway, the sound of music. Like, for instance, drum sounds is something that's changed immeasurably in the last few years, because you're modulating it all to sound good on streaming, and it's sounding good on streaming is completely different to how it would have sounded on a different outlet like vinyl or even on CD. Yeah, going back a few years.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you seen more or less artists sending in their music or demos since streaming services became so popular?
No. I still get unsolicited DMs from artists. I get emails from artists. I suddenly find myself on mailing lists that I never knew I was on. The appetite on the artist's behalf to get themselves across is probably more keenly felt. Now, beforehand, I distinctly recall people would just send in CDs and there'd be no follow-up. People are keener now to follow up on, I've sent you this, did you get a chance to listen to it, particularly if they want to get themselves on the radio rather than just on a playlist. But yeah, like the streaming services, I don't think it's had a massive impact in how stuff is sent to people. It's slightly different given the fact that you have to listen to it electronically. But no, I think people are still the same. They still want to get their message across to an intermediary who's going to get it out to a bigger audience than they could do on their own.
How do you think streaming services have affected radio listenership in general?
Like I said earlier, I think it's affected how young people have interacted with media massively, and radio has probably felt the reaction to that, and it's trying to play catch up with streaming services, and it's trying to be an equal of streaming services when they probably now just need to find themselves a point of difference and build upon their point of difference and decide what it is that makes them unique in comparison to streaming services and build upon that, because to try and match them and to try and just churn out what the big streaming services have or what's popular in streaming services, it's not the way to go, and it's going to be a law of diminishing returns if they keep doing that.
Yeah. What inspired you to start a career in broadcasting, and how did you get started?
What inspired me? I actually don't necessarily know what inspired me. I knew I didn't want to do an office job wearing a tie and wearing a suit, whatever, that every day. And I guess, got back to primary school, I had one teacher who said, you should do journalism. And that was when I was like 7 or 8. So I guess it kind of was a steady progress from there. As regards my start, I started in pirate radio, started in a station called Phantom. So we were based above where Whelan's is now in Dublin city centre. And I was initially given a slot on Monday nights that didn't exist before. So I was on between 10 and midnight and was basically given room to learn and to make mistakes and to become better, which necessarily hasn't happened. But I was given time to kind of work at being a broadcaster without any pay, first of all, but without any real my criticism or pressure for it to be brilliant from day one. So you kind of have time to grow when you're in that environment. Legally, no. I could never actually say that out loud, obviously enough. But no, like pirate radio for generations of broadcasters in this country. And I don't know if I'm even one of the last ones, because it's not necessarily the force that it was back in the, certainly not in the 80s, but definitely not in the 90s and 2000s. But it's a brilliant place. There's so many people in this building. Came through the same avenue via different stations or via the same station, but it was such a perfect way to learn your trade. Yeah.
And how has Off the Ball changed since expanding into podcasting and not just being a radio show?
I think hugely, again, in a different way, we've been able to explore different avenues that we haven't necessarily been constrained by having just the 2-3 hours of radio per evening. Like, that's an awful lot of information from the course of the day to try and squeeze into those 2-3 hours. So it has provided a bit of room to stretch our legs, to try out different products, to cater to different listeners' needs, like to have like a specific golf podcast or to have a specific racing podcast, and to have even like League of Ireland coverage. And that's something that has been led by our ability to podcast stuff and our ability to broadcast on the fly digitally rather than just over broadcast radio.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for listening to this year's TY Takeover. I hope you enjoyed it. This year's Takeover was produced by me, Ben Ashmore, Rossa Alcock, Rory O'Reilly, Andrew McDonnell, Charlie Dunney, Kate McNamara, Rosemary O'Reilly, Conor Fitzsimons, Ava Foy, Anna Strapp, Tom Hickey, Nathan Smith, and was funded by Commissioner Naman.